First, we're going to have George Galloway, a Member of Parliament from the United Kingdom. We'll discuss campus activities in 1968 and compare them with campus activities in 2000.
TikTok, TikTok. Now we're running a poll on it. Who do you trust least? TikTok, Meta, that is, of course, Facebook, or X, that is, of course, Elon Musk. It's rather a low poll at the minute. 19,000 people have voted, and I've only just mentioned it, but extraordinarily perspicacious, because it turns out in our poll of getting on for 20,000 people, the public trust TikTok the most of these three big platforms, social media giants. That'll be why TikTok is the one that's getting the boot, at least from the United States, though what happens in the United States very frequently crosses the Atlantic with increased rapidity. So who knows who'll be next to ban TikTok? Well, I'm actually sitting in the British Parliament right now, and guess what? TikTok is banned in the British Parliament. I can get Twitter, I can get Meta, Facebook, Instagram, any of these things. In fact, there are things that I could get that I don't want to get, but which are sent to me anonymously by X, for example. I get nudes in bio, sex bots all day, every day, here in the British Parliament, but I can't get TikTok. That's because China is now officially an enemy. I can't go into it too deeply because it's a live trial, but two members of staff in this very building, not my members of staff employed by leading conservative critics of mine who are never done telling me that I'm a traitor, those two members of staff of Conservative MPs have been arrested and charged with spying for China, which is described in the indictment as an enemy, about which more later. The truth is, TikTok is being banned not actually because it's Chinese. TikTok is being banned because the Israel lobby in the United States has placed on record that we have a TikTok problem. What they really mean is we have a young people's problem. Young people in overwhelming number all over the United States, including young Jewish people in unvanquishable and ever-growing numbers, are a problem for the Israel lobby because there's an uprising going on in the United States amongst young people against the crimes being committed by the apartheid genocidal state of Israel. It can be seen on the campuses of America's great universities and even now some of its less than great, at least less than famous universities. Yale has risen up. NYU has risen up. Columbia, above all, has risen up. And the more the authorities bring in the National Guard, anti-terrorist police, I'm not making that up, the more they try to describe the protests of the students in America's universities as hate fests, even nests of terrorism, the more the young people are standing up to them. It is a truly inspiring phenomenon, last seen in the United States in 1968, when an uprising on campuses all over America began over the American war, genocidal war against the people of Vietnam. In 1968, there was another senile Democratic president by the name of Lyndon Baines Johnson, who may very well have murdered his predecessor, Jack Kennedy, in Dallas, who became the president who intensified the Vietnam War to unprecedented levels. In 1968, that senile American crook, Lyndon Baines Johnson, ordered the National Guard onto the campus at Kent State University. and gunned down. More than 20 people, more than 20 students were shot down, many of them killed by the National Guard on the orders of a Democratic Party president because they were protesting against an unjust genocidal war. Well, they say history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes. That's what Joe Biden is doing right now. And in the lead-up to the Democratic Party's convention, this uprising will follow him all the way to the podium. And no doubt, his goons will club them down like they did the young people protesting the Vietnam War in Chicago in 1968. The whole world is watching, the crowd chanted, as Mayor Richard Daley's thugs laid into them, fired gas at them, clubbed them down, even shot them. Well, the whole world is watching Joe genocide Biden as he does exactly the same thing in the uprising on campus. But the uprising on TikTok is, if anything, more significant because these are not students at Ivy League universities, brave but privileged and a small minority of America's population. On TikTok, millions upon millions are rising up to say, "Hey, Joe, where are you going with that ban in your hand? How dare you threaten to close down TikTok? We get a lot of our information from there," and therein lies the problem. There are 10 times as many videos on TikTok because there are 10 times as many people posting them in support of the beleaguered, besieged, and massacred people of Gaza than there are supporting the genocidal apartheid state of Israel. Well, you'd expect that, wouldn't you? How many supporters do you really think that Netanyahu has outside of Israel for these massacres? Well, not many on TikTok, that's for sure. And that's why Joe Biden today in the Oval Office committed an act of international piracy. He held a gun at the head of the American company that owns TikTok in America and said, "Sell. Sell to someone we approve of or we're closing you down." That's the new American law. It's freedom, you see. The land of the free. Sorry, free. It is democracy, don't you know, in America. And democracy in the United Kingdom isn't much better. Little Rishi Sunak was in Berlin today. Must have been quite a task for people to work out which was the more diminutive of the two rulers on view. Little Soldier Schultz or little Rishi Sunak, who's taken, by the way, I can confirm, having stood right next to him in the corridor in Westminster last week, taken to wearing elevator heels. I don't know if Schultz did. I don't know if they had a measuring contest of who had the biggest elevator heels. But the two of them were acting big. The two of them were strutting around, planning a European army. The very thing that they said during the Brexit referendum was swivel-eyed lunacy to suggest that's what they were planning. They are now going to have a European army. And though Britain is not in the EU because its people decided to leave it, we're going to be in the EU's army. And moreover, we're going to lead that army, don't you know? It's like going back to Waterloo in 1815. Us and General Blücher are going to make sure that Johnny Frenchman doesn't establish a leading role in that European army. Us and the Germans are going to take the lead. In order to persuade us of the wisdom of that, the government sent little Grant Shapps. How many of these miniatures do the Tory government have in their cabinet room? Little Grant Shapps, as he's now known, he used to be known by a multiplicity of names, when he was pretending to be various identities in his previous business career. He was sacked ignominiously from many minor positions in the Conservative government. But now, little Grant Shapps is our war leader. And what a war leader. He's going to spend not 2% of our GDP when France and many other, Italy, many other European countries don't spend anything like 2% of their GDP, their people demanding instead houses and hospitals, schools, better health for their people, more economic opportunity for their people. In Britain, we spend 2%. It's an ironclad consensus, you see, between Labour and the Conservatives. Let's spend as much as we can possibly get away with on weapons and war. Moreover, weapons which our own people in our own armed forces won't even see. It was made plain by little Grant Shapps today that most of the increase in expenditure, 75 billion extra per year, is going to the Ukraine. It's actually going to little Zelensky. Another midget is getting another huge tranche of the 75 billion pounds extra on top of the hundreds of billions we already spend is going to Zelensky in a war which may well be lost by the summer holidays, judging by the pace of Russia's advances, the collapse of the Ukrainian lines. The lines of coke remain vibrant. The military lines are collapsing like a house of cards. So it may very well be that before Britain has managed to send the extra money, little Zelensky is sitting on the beach in Miami or in Tel Aviv or perhaps in both. The British government's bravado over spending even more money on weapons and war to send to Ukraine is only possible because the so-called opposition in Britain is in lockstep with little Rishi and little Grant. As the Tories pledged 2.5% of GDP on weapons and war, Labour cried out for more. Why only 2.5%? Are you really going to do it? Or is this just an announcement for show? Summed up the Labour response. Well, my take on it is this. If I went anywhere in Britain and pointed to a pothole, pointed to a derelict building, pointed to a shaky bridge, pointed to a decrepit motorway, if I went to any hospital and went into the A&D and saw the line for 12, 15 hours to be seen by a doctor, if I went to a school with crumbling infrastructure and not enough tech equipment, a field for football that resembles something that's been bombed by a warplane, and asked the parents there, should we spend this money here in this school, in this hospital, on these houses, on this motorway, on filling these potholes, or should we send it to Zelensky? I can assure you that 99% of the people would choose the former rather than the latter. But hey, that's democracy, shamocracy, where both parties, the only two possible governments, are in such lockstep that, like the animals in George Orwell's Animal Farm, you look from man to pig and pig to man and man to pig and back again, and you cannot tell the difference. And that is exactly true also in the United States of America. Let me close on the Al-Shifa and Nasser mass graves. I might as well, because not one single British broadcaster or British newspaper has covered in more than News in Brief, and usually not in News in Brief at all, the fact that 700 corpses, many with their hands tied behind their back, many still in scrubs, many still in bandages with their stitches visible on their wounded stomachs, have been found in mass graves. Now, for someone of my generation who remembers the sights and sounds of the Red Army's liberation of the Nazi death camps, the beast of Berlin's worst crimes, the sight of mass graves, emaciated children, the sight of lacerated, mutilated children, the sight of gaunt, starving, sick people being found in a mass grave arouses in me a passion which I can scarcely quench sufficiently not to swear into this camera right now. But somehow, the mass media in Britain is able to ignore it with absolute equanimity. They don't give a damn, won't even report it, never mind analyze it. And in the House of Commons today, the Labour leadership raised anything, everything but these mass graves, the ongoing genocide, massacre of the Palestinian civilian population, most of them women and children. They didn't even raise it. They didn't allow the word Gaza to cross their lips, and neither did a single Labour member of Parliament. It was left to a young woman, the deputy leader of the SNP, the Scottish National Party, to raise the existence of these mass graves and to compare the outrage over alleged mass graves in the Ukraine with the total silence over the mass graves in hospitals in Gaza. The deputy prime minister, because little Rishi was away standing on top of a tank to avoid looking like the prime minister he is, the deputy prime minister scolded the SNP deputy leader. How dare she compare the crimes of Russia with the crimes of a democracy in Israel? In Russia, he said, we have an authoritarian dictatorship. But a democratic country can commit genocide much more nicely, apparently. He said, we can be sure that democratic Israel will investigate any allegations of misconduct. That's how he describes dead bodies shot in the back of the head with their arms tied behind their back, still in their medical uniforms. These are allegations of misconduct. Moreover, we can be confident that democratic Israel will properly investigate them. Now, I'm going to say something very strong, which if I said downstairs in the chamber of the House of Commons, would have me removed from the building and banned for the rest of the day, if not for longer. The Deputy Prime Minister of the United Kingdom is a liar. He knows extremely well, must do, he's seen the Foreign Office legal advice that they're refusing to show the rest of us. Not only that, democratic Israel is committing war crimes, crimes against humanity, crimes which plausibly in the words of the ICJ, can be described as genocide. He knows that. But he calls them allegations of misconduct and misleads the House of Commons, though I'm glad to say not most of the public, that any allegations of misconduct by Israel will be. If you believe that, I've got a bridge here in London. I could sell you going cheap.
And that was British Member of Parliament George Galloway. Coming up next, we're going to hear an interview with Norm Finkelstein that took place on Turkish public media.
Thank you so much, Norman, for allowing us to come. I'm hoping that we can, and also how we can still genuinely honor. But before engage, does your approach as a thing involve so much rigor? And
my parents were refugees from Europe. They came over after the war. They were literate. I would say my mother was hyper-literate. She attended a good school. She got a classical education. She knew Latin. She knew French. She knew classical music. She was apparently quite good at math. When the war was verging, she was enrolled in the mathematics faculty at Warsaw University, which I assume was unusual because she was a woman and she was Jewish. Despite those two obstacles, she was enrolled in the mathematics faculty. After the war, my father was a vocational worker. He was a factory worker. I have to say, I didn't have that much contact with my father because it was an era in which factory workers got up early. It was before alarm clocks. Mm-hmm. Alarm clock was a luxury. You just had an internal alarm clock. And he got up promptly at 6 a.m. I'm sure not much different than a serf or a peasant in middle Europe. They didn't have a contraption called an alarm clock. And he went to work. He worked 6 days a week. To be precise, 5.5. He worked on Saturdays until 2 o'clock. And the remainder of the time at home, he was sleeping. It was not an easy life for my father. My mother, she had to raise 3 children on her own. That may not sound like a big task for your listeners, but when I say on her own, I mean that literally, because every single member of her family before the war and every single member of my father's family before the war was exterminated. So she couldn't turn to a sister to help out, grandparent, her parents to help out, and she didn't trust anybody. There was no way she would ever have a babysitter. So she was, as they say, a hands-on mother, which meant very little time for my father or for my mother for intellectual activity. However, they read the New York Times, which was the newspaper of record back then. They read it religiously. They read every page. That was a family ritual. The Sunday New York Times came in a large number of sections. There was the magazine section, the book review section, the arts section, of course, the business section, and the 2 news sections. It was a very thick paper, very thick. And I remember at Sunday morning, there was also the sports section. And on Sunday morning at breakfast, we would divide up which section are you going to get. Oh, and there was also the news of the week in review section, because you had to read as a kid. Let's say in history class in 10th grade, Mrs. Gerstenhaber, we would get quizzes on the news of the week in review. You had to read it for school, but we read it as a family. So even as there wasn't time for intellectual activity, given the burdens of my father's work and my mother's work at home, there wasn't time. Still, it's a Jewish family, and the life of the mind was a premium was attached to the life of the mind. Nobody had to tell us to do well in school. Nobody had to order us to do well in school. You just knew you had to do well in school. It just went with the, it was just part of a Jewish cultural milieu. It was, I grew up in a highly, highly competitive and ambitious neighborhood. And competition and ambition, I gave my all.
I just want to, you've done so much, and I think people.
Look, the last 6 months have been brutal for me. I'm not a young man. And I did not expect this to happen at all. I had given up on Gaza in 2020. I had chronicled it for 15 years. I gave 42 years of my life to the Israel-Palestine conflict. That's all I did. That's all I did. Read and reread and reread and reread these human rights reports, because I basically consider myself a forensic scholar. Forensic means I try to analyze the evidence, in particular the evidence that Israel brings forth, and try to show why it's not true, why it's false. And it's never blatantly false, or sometimes it's blatantly false, but most of the time it's not. And it requires a huge amount of concentration to read it and reread it and reread it to find the errors in the logic, the errors in the alleged evidence, the juxtaposition between what was said on page 3, what was said on page 30, and what was said on page 300. You know, and but you have to keep rereading it and rereading it to see, wait, but they said that on page 3, but they also said that on page, you know. So I did that for 42 years. As a matter of fact, I'll just get up for 1/2 second. How did I start out? Oh, excuse me. Did I drop something?
No problem.
Okay. So, how did I start out in this whole thing? I was a follower of Mao Zedong, a Maoist, in the 1970s. And I was a fanatic. I was a true believer. I also still maintained my intellectual self-respect. And there were people of very high intellectual caliber. Paul Sweezy, my professor and friend, Charles Bettelheim. These were people of a very high intellectual order who were also Maoists, and I read them. I studied under them. That proved I suffered from many illusions. And those illusions were shattered, they were pulverized when Mao Zedong passed and everything was turned upside down shortly after his passing. And then in 1982, so I was shattered when that happened. I felt, it wasn't just that I was wrong, it was I felt like a fool. I had dismissed everybody who disagreed with me in the language of the day as being a bourgeois or a petty bourgeois. That's the language we used. And it turned out they were right. And I was very arrogant, very cocky, very sure of myself. I did read a lot, but I didn't read the other side. I read my side. And so I was completely sure. I was bedridden for 3 weeks. As I said, not so much from being wrong, but being humiliated. So in June 1982, Israel invaded Lebanon. I was always a political activist. Israel and Palestine weren't on my radar at all. not at all. Then Israel invades Lebanon. I got involved as an activist. And then, for reasons not worth going into, I decided, hey, this is a subject for a doctoral dissertation. And I, even though I had finished my coursework at Princeton, I hadn't yet written the dissertation. So I figured, what the hell? I'll write my doctoral dissertation on the subject, as I chose the subject of Zionism. That was my doctoral dissertation, was a study of the theory of Zionism. And just as I was finishing up the dissertation in 1982 or 83, just as I was finishing it up, I start reading about this book called From Time Immemorial. This is the book. And this book claims that it's going to revolutionize our understanding of the Israel-Palestine conflict, and everything that we thought about it was wrong. And it said, the claim was that the author proves through this rigorous demographic study Palestine was empty on the eve of Zionist colonization. The Zionists came to Palestine, made the desert bloom, and then all these Arabs from neighboring countries surreptitiously entered Palestine and claimed to be indigenous to the land. Okay, a lot of people on what you might call the pro-Palestine, I don't like that term, on the pro-Palestine community dismissed this, oh, this is just Zionist garbage, you know. I wasn't ready to do that. Why? Because not too long ago, I had dismissed everybody who didn't share my views of China as being a bourgeois or petty bourgeois. And now I'm hearing, oh, that's just Zionist this and Zionist that. And I thought, no, once bitten, twice shy. I'm not going to make that mistake again of just dismissing what I didn't agree with. And so I sat down. I was working at that point in a settlement house with kids, poor kids, from projects, what we call projects in the city. And I used to work on my dissertation in the morning, work at the settlement house in the afternoon, and then go home and do work on my dissertation at night. And then with this book, I decide I'm not making that mistake again. And I start to read the book and read the book and read the book and read the book. I've got to know whether what she's saying is true. Because if it's true, I'm out of here. I'm not going to support what's not true. So if this is the truth, then the cause is fake, a fake, I'm out. And so the book had at the end these tables, as you could see. I didn't use calculators or anything back then. I just used paper and pencil. And I'm going over it and over it and over it. And one night, it was like 1 a.m., I suddenly discovered that the demographic data was faked. I can't tell you, you know, it's so long ago now, it's almost a half century ago. My heart started to palpitate, and I broke out into a sweat. I lived in a small studio apartment. I started to pace it back and forth, pace it back and forth. And I kept saying, I did it. I did it. I proved the book is a fraud. And without going into all the other details, that's how I began a career as a forensic scholar. And I did that for 42 years. And then in 2020, I decided it's over. They lost. The cause is lost. And I had given up on Gaza. Even my last books on the topic, the last two, were these two. This was Gaza, an inquest into its martyrdom. And at the very end of the book, the very end, I say, if I can find it, the author holds out faint hope that this book will find an audience among his contemporaries. Still, the truth should be preserved. It is the least that's owed the victims. Perhaps one day in the remote future, when the tenor of the times is more receptive, someone will stumble across this book, collecting dust on a library shelf, blow off the cobwebs, and be stung by outrage at the lot of a people, the people of Gaza, if not forsaken by God, then betrayed by the cupidity and corruption, careerism and cynicism, cravenness and cowardice of mortal men. So, I didn't think anyone would read the book. I didn't. When the case came before the International Criminal Court, not the ICJ, not the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, I wrote this long, simply dissection of the evidence presented by Israel in order to help out in the criminal court proceeding. The book, as my publisher lamented, sold about 350 copies, most of which were purchased by me to give to people at The Hague for the case. And that was it. Nobody read it. 350 copies sold, half of them I purchased, which means a huge amount of work. Huge amount of work. About 100 people may have read it. You know, I gave up. So when October 7th happened, I had already moved on to other subjects, but I was physically tired. You know, I'll be honest, physically depleted, I'll be honest about it. So I wasn't ready. No one was the first thing I had to do.
You bring this forensic scholarship approach also, as I was starting off with at the beginning, to memory. And I'm wondering, how did you get involved in that? When was the first time you got involved with the forensic approach to the politics of memory and looking at how various states, whether any weaponized memory for nefarious purposes?
Well, the only book of mine that ever sold was The Holocaust Industry. That was a complete fluke. You know, it's funny, the genesis of these things. There was a book written by a University of Chicago professor named Peter Novick. It was called The Holocaust in American Life. Now, one thing I knew about from life experience was the Holocaust and American life, because my parents were authentic survivors of the Nazi Holocaust. They came here as refugees. When we were growing up, they were scornfully referred to as greenhorns. Greenhorn meant that you don't know the ways of the United States, because a lot of the Jews that we came in contact with, they came over, their families came over in the great wave of Jewish immigration at the turn of the 20th century, okay? So they grew up in the Jewish ghettos in New York, places like Brownsville and so forth. And they were already, they were second or third generation already. So they knew how to be an American. And my parents were greenhorns. They were not yet assimilated to American life. So they come over, and I knew exactly what the experience of Jews who survived the Nazi Holocaust, what was their experience in the United States? It was my parents. So when I read the book, The Holocaust in American Life, there were parts I agreed with, parts I didn't agree with, and I was pretty confident about my judgments. But there were some things I strongly disagreed with. So my publisher at the time, very small little publishing house called Verso, the head of the Verso at the time is a fellow named Colin Robinson. And Colin Robinson, whatever conversation you're having, whatever conversation, you can be talking about, oh, it's going to be a nice day out tomorrow. And he says, why don't you write a book about it? Whenever you say, he says, why don't you write a book about it? So he says, why don't you write a book about the Nelvig Holocaust in American Life? So I sat down. I first wrote a review of the book for the London Review of Books. It was the last time they ever had me in their ranks. And then I said, okay, I'll turn it into a book. And it did have an impact. It became an international bestseller. It's very hard to calculate how many copies a book sells because a lot of countries don't have copyright laws. And so pirated editions. And so a large part of the Middle East, where the book was popular for reasons which are fairly obvious, there all these pirated editions came out. Of course, one of my dreads is how it was translated and whether they were faithful to the precision of my language, or it became the Jews invented the Holocaust, which wasn't the point of the book, actually. I had also, before the Holocaust industry, I had written another book on the, not myself. Myself and a German historian, Ruth Bettina Byrne, we wrote a book on this book by a fellow who's long been forgotten, named Daniel Jonah Goldhagen. It was called Hitler's Willing Executioners, which was a huge international event, the publication of that book. I thought the book was garbage. And I sat down and I dissected it. I think I produced a competent piece of forensic scholarship. And then with the after that came the Holocaust industry, where I got involved again in the question of the Nazi Holocaust, not as a historical event about which I never felt I had the competence to comment on, but as an ideological event, namely how the Nazi Holocaust had been instrumentalized in order to both shield Israel from criticism, and also at that point it was being used as a blackmail weapon against various European countries, starting with Switzerland. And there, obviously, the efficacy of the Holocaust weapon has over time been seriously diminished because of overuse. So I don't think it's nearly as effective now as it was then, with obviously the exception of Germany itself, where it's used to intimidate Germany into doing things which they have to know. are wrong. But I will grant this. I think Germany is in a morally a very difficult situation because it is very hard for them to criticize Israel because of that historical baggage. I get that. I'm not going to deny it. I just wish, and I don't want to sound vulgar, I just wish they would shut up. They know what they're doing is wrong. Why do you have to do it in such a flagrant, such an outrageous way? You could just say, for historical reasons, we feel uncomfortable criticizing Israel. We'll simply defer to the consensus opinion of the EU. Okay? That, to me, would be a reasonable position. But to defend what's going on now, until about 3 weeks ago, unconditionally, unacceptable. If I were in Germany and I saw the chancellor, I would spit in his face. No. No. Unacceptable. I understand the moral dilemma. I get that. But with the exception of Germany, I would say the Holocaust weapon hasn't been particularly effective in recent years. Now in the Democratic Party, because the mantle of the Democratic Party became identity politics. At its base, like the Black Lives Matter movement, and all kindred movements like that, they had adopted the cause, it's true. And then when October 7th happened, and thereafter the genocide in Gaza, that base now was energized by Palestine, because already they were supportive of the cause, and that created the big split in the party now, where the leadership doesn't know what to do. The Biden, Schumer, before Nancy Pelosi, that leadership doesn't know what to do, because it created this monster, namely, it invested in the identity politics, and now the identity politics is saying, well, Israel too is a settler colonial state. That was part of identity politics. Israel is oppressing the Palestinian identity, you know. And so, in a way, the identity politics backfired on the Democratic Party because the leadership is deeply entrenched, both ideologically and financially. It's deeply entrenched in supporting Israel. But the base of the Democratic Party, because it was created on the ideology of identity politics, the base is totally committed to Palestine. And so, as I said, it was a kind of, it backfired on the party because the base had appropriated Palestine as its cause.
Actually, you frame it so well because, yes, there's the identity politics at the grassroots level and then also at that elite level.
And the elite level never adopted Palestine.
Because they seem to have been so, for years, so progressive. I even remember the moment I came back from graduate school, just going through some of the Canadian newspapers, and I was thinking, since when have you become, has the establishment become so, am I supposed to feel happy? I guess so.
Because
when did you become invested in social justice? Like, I don't remember.
Because
that.
It was a fake social justice. It was social justice without class. But what happened was they didn't really care whether the base was pro-Palestine because the cause seemed dead. And so all these activists are for BDS. Nobody cared because right now, what was the only thing? There were no negotiations going on. There was no peace process anymore. The whole thing. On October 7th, it wasn't over. And they were in a huge, not were, every day. It's evident that the Biden administration is in a huge mess. Because just today, if you don't mind, I was just today, how Gaza protesters are challenging Democratic leaders. The top story in the Times. The whole base... Because of the identity politics, that's the irony. The whole base, because of the identity politics, is in revolt against the leadership. And the leadership created the identity politics in order to get a base to replace the white working class. It was an irony. It was an irony. I mean, people said to me, you have to admit, Norm, for all of your criticism of identity politics, you have to admit they did put Palestine on the map, which is true. Yes. It's true. My credo in life is never quarrel with facts. That's factually true. You have to explain it, the facts. You can't ignore them. And I think the explanation is the whole thing backfired because they thought the cause was dead, so they didn't care. Ah, let them shout BDS. Who cares? You know, it's been... As Zbigniew Brzezinski famously said, he was the national security advisor to Carter at one point in the eternal peace process. He says it's bye-bye PLO. It was his famous line, bye-bye PLO, meaning the representative Palestinian organization at the time, the Palestine Liberation Organization. And it looked like it was bye-bye Palestine. Remember, before October 7th, what was everybody talking about? The Abraham Accords, Saudi Arabia joining with Israel and the United States in the defense pact, and there was no talk about the Palestinians. So the whole thing backfired because suddenly the Palestine cause sprung to life again, and it had become one of the litmus tests of the identity politics movement, though it seemed at before October 7th, it seemed like an irrelevancy. So it was, as I said, in this case, it really was complicated what happened. It requires a fine analysis.
So just before we wrap up, Norman, I wanted to ask you, because you've, to your credit, so consistently been able to exercise a certain degree of equanimity in the face of a great deal of opposition throughout your academic career and as an activist. And I wonder if you have any advice for journalists or activists who might be experiencing similar.
The advice is very simple. There was a philosopher, his name was Julian Bender, and he wrote a little book. It's called in French, La Trahison, Trahison des Clercs, or the Treason of the Intellectuals. I'm going to get it, because just give me one moment. It's going to be right up here, because it's a little book, The Treason of the Intellectuals. It's a complex book, but one of his core theses, not all, but one is, there are basically two sets of values in the world. One are material values. Everybody knows them. Fame and fortune. Fame and fortune, power and privilege. Fame and fortune, power and privilege. It's what 99% of humanity strives for. You want a little recognition in life, a little fame, what Andy Warhol famously called the 15 minutes of fame. Everybody wants their 15 minutes of self-recognition. And everybody wants a little money, a little privilege. You want the power, you want the privilege. You want the fame, the 15 minutes of fame, and you want some fortune. That's what 99% of people strive towards. And Benda calls that the real world values, the material values of the material world. And then he says, on the other hand, there's a tiny fraction of people who strive for spiritual values. And the spiritual values, everybody knows. The cameraman knows. The cameraman's assistant knows. The sound man knows. It's called truth and justice. Okay? Those are... So here we have fame and fortune, and here we have truth and justice. And Benda says, those two sets of values always come into conflict. There's a fundamental contradiction between the two. The more fame you have, the more fortune you have, the less truth is there is in your life, and the less justice there is in your life. If you want to stay faithful to those values of your youth, the values of truth and justice, the idealistic values, we call young people who embrace those values, we call them idealistic, which is true, because what's the opposite of idealistic? Materialistic. And it's Benda's spiritual material, idealistic, materialistic, okay? So don't expect reward. It comes with the turf. I'm at the end of my life. I made decisions at a very young age, relatively young age, I would say around 15. It was clear to me the path I would carve out in life, the trajectory I would take. I don't think it would be fair to say I've deviated from it. What I set out to do, I did. I've been bitter. I've been angry. I've been furious at what I felt to be were betrayals of me personally by people I counted as friends and comrades. Only thing I regret at this particular moment is I don't have the mental energy or the physical wherewithal to rise to the present occasion. I do my best. It's the best that I can do. But at this particular moment, I feel it's inadequate to the task at hand. Horrors that are being inflicted on those God-forsaken people, half of whom are children.
Thank you so much. Very moving as well for myself. Just wondering, it's wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you.